Once upon a time, there was a pig farmer. He had three sows that he wanted to mate with his neighbor's boar. One morning, after calling to make arrangements, he loaded these three pigs in the back of his pickup truck and he drove to his friend's farm. There he unloaded the sows, he put them in the pen with the male pig and left them there for the rest of the day. When he returned that afternoon, he asked his neighbor how he would know if the mating was successful. His friend told him, he said, "Well, in the morning when you wake up, if the pigs are rolling in the grass, you know it took. But if they're rolling in the mud, you know it didn't." Well, the next morning, the farmer, he ran to the window to check on his sows, and there they all were. All three girls were out there rolling in the mud. Well, the farmer was disappointed, but if at first you don't succeed, try again. And so he loaded his pigs back in the pickup truck, took them back to his friend's farm, put them in the pen with the boar, and promised to return that afternoon. When he arrived that day, again he asked, he said, "Now how do I know if little piglets are on the way?" The neighbor repeated himself. He said, "If they're rolling in the grass, you know it took. If they're rolling in the mud, you know it didn't." Well, as soon as he woke up the next day, he looked out the window, and there those pigs were. They were rolling in the mud. Well, undaunted, he loaded up his sows a third time, and he returned to his neighbor's house. At the end of the day, he asked his friend one more time. He said, "Let me make sure I got this straight. If they're rolling in the grass, I know it took. If they're rolling in the mud, I know it didn't." He said, "That's right, you got it." Well, that night, the farmer had to fly out of town. But the next morning, he called his wife. And he asked her to look out the window and tell him, "Are the pigs rolling in the grass or are they rolling in the mud?" Well, he waited and he waited and he waited. Well, finally, his wife returned to the phone. He had to know. He said, "Honey, tell me, are the pigs rolling in the grass or are they rolling in the mud?" She responded, "Neither. Two of them are in the back of your truck and one is in the cab honking a horn." Obviously, that man's neighbor's male pig was no boar. The moral of the story is that God created sex not just for breeding, but for blessing. The Creator designed sex not just for our procreation, but for our pleasure. You know, if all God cared about in repopulating the planet was repopulating the planet, then cloning or cell division would have done the job. But sex brings a husband and a wife together in a wonderful way, a way that creates intimacy and enjoyment. Sex fuses two lives and solidifies our commitment and our closeness. Make no mistake about it, when God created sex, like everything else he created, he said that it was good. Well, tonight we want to look at the biblical account of Solomon and the Shulamite. The Song of Solomon describes how lavish a source of intimacy and ecstasy sex can be between a husband and a wife. Since sex is so often abused and misused in our society, we get the impression that sex is evil, but not so. That's certainly not God's take on the subject. Hebrews 13, verse 4 reads, "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled." The word there translated bed in verse 4 is the Greek word for sexual intercourse. Proverbs chapter 5, verses 18 and 19 daringly declares, "Rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her breast satisfy you at all times. Always be enraptured with her love." Hey, God is no prude. His version of sex as it should be is so graphic. The language here in the Song of Solomon was so erotic and sensual that the Jewish rabbis prohibited their young men from even reading the Song of Solomon until they had turned 30 years old. I'm telling you, these eight chapters will steam your glasses. They'll race your pulse. They'll cause your face to blush. But just remember, God isn't blushing. God wrote the book on sex, and he wants us to read it and understand it and even model it in our marriages. You know, a trip to the local bookstore will turn up thousands of sex manuals, but there's only one written by the Creator, and that is the Song of Solomon. Well, this evening, we're going to chart the sexual highs and lows of Solomon and the Shulamite. marriage, and especially sex in marriage, is not always fireworks and red-hot 4th of Julys. There are occasionally chilly days where the temperature dips near freezing. At times, the sex sizzles. At other times, it fizzles. But most of the time, it's somewhere in between. And this was the experience of Shlomo and Shula. If you want to take notes tonight and maybe jot a few things down, I suggest you do. I've outlined their ups and downs as follows. The bill for sex, the thrill of sex, the frills to sex, the skill in sex, and then the chill on sex. Here it is again in shorthand form, five movements. The bill, the thrill, the frills, the skill, and the chill. Now, before we pry into their sex life, let me first introduce you to our couple. Solomon, you probably know. He was the king of Israel. One day, his royal entourage was weaving its way through the countryside when he saw this beautiful maiden keeping watch over her family's flocks. Solomon returned to meet her, disguised as a shepherd. And it was only after she had fallen in love with him and agreed to marry him that he revealed his true identity. Well, the Shulamite, she was a country girl, a hillbilly babe, sort of a Carrie Underwood type. Beautiful, but a little backwoods. And this was why Solomon had fallen in love with her. His palace was full of the cover girls, the pampered pinups with the store-bought beauty. But the Shulamite, she was different. Hers was a natural beauty, a simple, rustic, yet stunning beauty. She had the perfections of a rose. She had the attractiveness of a field of wild dandelions. And she was an honest woman. She had virtue and character, undefiled by the big city. Her country charm and innocence had caused the king to fall in love with her. He had taken her to be his wife and moved her to the palace. Well, chapter 1 opens with her already in Jerusalem. She is a new queen in new surroundings. During their country courtship, it was just her and her shepherd, just the two of them, Shlomo and Shula. The days were free, the hours were private, the duties were light. But now she's the wife of the king, and she has servants and responsibilities. And Solomon is about his daily duties as well. He's busy attending to affairs of state and often late arriving back to the palace. Life has changed for them both. She's not used to sharing her husband with so many people. And now that she's back in Jerusalem, she's also painfully aware that there are other women in the palace who would long to be with her husband. She sees the looks. They would love to be with the king. You see, upon moving into the city, she realizes that she now has competition. And this is why in chapter 1, the book opens with her questioning her attractiveness, nursing her insecurities. Listen to her sulk in chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. I am dark, but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They make me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. You see, the Shulamite bemoans the fact that her skin is tough and tanned. She feels inferior. The palace princesses, they were always indoors. They were pampered with bubble baths and facials. Their skin was moisturized. They had creamy complexions. But the Shulamite had been out in the fields under the hot sun, caring a lot more about her brother's sheep than about her own appearance. When it comes to herself, she feels inferior, and she wonders why Solomon would ever love the likes of her. Men, you with me? Everybody still with me? Men, the first step toward a healthy sex life for you and your wife is for you to show a sensitivity toward your wife's insecurity. You see, the bill, if you will, the cost for a vibrant, vigorous sexual intimacy is sensitivity. For fellas, just like the Shulamite maiden, your wife has some misgivings about her physical appearance. A recent Harris poll revealed that 99% of all women, that's a pretty good percentage, 99% of all women wish they could change something about their body. The popularity of breast implants and fanny tucks and facelifts testify to female insecurities. Men, your wife won't give herself freely and uninhibitedly to you unless she's certain that you're satisfied with what you're getting. This is why you are a blabbering idiot if you are ever critical or condemning of your wife's appearance. Did I say that strong enough? If you want her to want you, then praise how she looks. Tell her how much you love the special features that God has created in her, even the features she's added over the years. The more assurance you bring, the more affirmation you send her, the more trust she has in your acceptance, in your affirmation, the more she'll be able to open up and loosen up in her sexual expression. Well, this is what Solomon does. Look how he speaks to her concerns in verses 8 through 10. He says, "If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold." Solomon is praising the Shulamite's beauty. He's assuring her that as far as he's concerned, she has no competition. The mention here of Pharaoh's filly was probably a reference to the daughter of Pharaoh, who had been given to Solomon in a diplomatic maneuver to ratify a peace treaty he had signed with Egypt. And the presence of this princess had added to the Shulamite's insecurities. Solomon lets his wife know that she is the only girl for him. Radical feminist Gloria Steinem was once asked why she had never married. Gloria responded, "I could never mate in captivity." Well, if Gloria wants to compare herself to a wild animal, that's up to her. But most of the women that I've talked to, they view marriage not as a captivity, but as an opportunity for creativity. For it's only when a woman is completely sure of her husband's acceptance and commitment can she release mentally and relax emotionally and explode sexually. Husbands, always remember, the bill for a healthy sex life is sensitivity to your wife's insecurity. Well, second, I want you to notice that the Shulamite describes the thrill of sex. She recalls one night in particular that characterized the early days of their marriage. The evening began at an official dinner, and it ended with a sexual feast. The king and queen were at a royal function when the Shulamite tells us what happened. Chapter 1, verse 12, "While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." That evening, the Shulamite had gone to dinner wearing a new perfume. I don't know what it was, but it might have been Hallel number 5. In the midst of the meal, it caught the king's attention. I mean, the aroma wafted across the room, and it was recognized by the king. The couple exchanged knowing glances. Just the look in each other's eyes aroused passion. Well, we're allowed to eavesdrop in on their conversation once the dinner was over and they had returned home. They're in the palace bedroom now when in verse 15, Solomon says to his bride, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes." Then the Shulamite answers him in verse 16, "Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green. The beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters of fir." Notice she's talking about the rafters, which means she must have been lying on her back. The Shulamite is inviting her husband to bed. In chapter 2, verse 1, she says, "I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys." But again, this is a sign of her insecurities. For in ancient Israel, roses and lilies were common flowers. Rather than go for $100 a dozen, you could pick roses anywhere. Here the Shulamite is bringing her insecurities to bed. self-doubt is about to spoil this evening unless a quick-thinking Solomon picks up the bill. And look at how he answers her in verse 2. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. I love that line. What a fantastic line. She calls herself a lily, but Solomon counters by saying, oh, a lily among thorns. Solomon was sensitive to his wife's reservations and insecurities and was quick to lay them to rest. Well, she continues, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. Now, this phrase translated lovesick, it means that she's exhausted from making love. The talk of raisin cakes and apples also have sexual overtones. Well, after a night of stimulating sex, in verse 7, the Shulamite has some advice for her single servants. She says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. As a nuclear reaction has to be contained, or it will cause great damage. Sex is an emotional fusion that should be reserved only for marriage. Now, there are three points I want to make from this episode. I want you to notice here the wooing, then the wording, and then the warning, for they all add to the thrill of sex. Notice first the wooing. You see, Solomon and the Shulamite began their foreplay long before they entered the bedroom. A book was published several years ago. It was entitled, Sex Begins in the Kitchen. I never read the book, but I never forgot the title. The implication is that little thoughts of kindness and thoughtfulness and tenderness throughout the day do more to arouse your wife sexually than does a sudden embrace at the end of the day. You see, good husbands recognize the differences in the sexual impulses of men and women. Men are turned on by sight. Just show the old boy a little leg and he'll go wild. But women are aroused slowly, more gradually. A stimulating night in bed begins with a kind word at breakfast, or a telephone call during the day, or help with the dishes, or even help with the kids with their homework and getting them to bed at night. See, women respond far more to forethought than they do to simply foreplay. You see, when it comes to sexual desire, men are like dry leaves. Oh, we're easily combustible. It didn't take much to get us ignited, and we burn out rather quickly. Whereas women are like charcoal. Oh, it takes longer and more effort to ignite them. I mean, lighting charcoal can be a very delicate job. You got to protect it from the wind, and you got to prime it with a little lighter fluid. And you might take several matches, you know, before you get her started. But once that charcoal begins to burn, it lasts a lot longer than a pile of leaves, let me tell you. Men, your wife has a deeper threshold for sexual enjoyment than you do. But if she's to experience it, she needs to be gently primed and protected and shown patience. Well, that's the wooing. Second here, I want you to notice the wording. Why all this symbolism? All this talk of apples and raisin cakes. I mean, what's this about? Realize when God speaks of sexual expression, he doesn't use slang terms. That'd be crass and crude. Neither does he use medical terms, which would sound unromantic and mechanical. God uses poetic symbolism to describe sexual expression. The Shulamite says, I sat down in his shade, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Man, when you think of that symbolically, her phrases are quite the turn on. Ladies, what sounds more appealing to you?
Hey, get on over here and let me inspect the merchandise.
Or, Let me visit your garden and enjoy its fruits. Now, I'm not going to give you any examples, but Kathy and I have had a lot of fun experimenting with our own phrases. I'm just saying, a great way for a couple to spice up their sex life is with some verbal stimulation. Don't talk dirty, but talk descriptive. Develop some fun, clean, poetic, yet suggestive language to stimulate your spouse and communicate what you desire. It's biblical, and it'll dramatically enhance your sexual relationship. And then finally here, Solomon issues a warning to his single servants. We may have a few singles here tonight. Sexual intimacy is so powerful and emotionally charged, it should be reserved for marriage. I've always thought of sex like super glue. Once it's applied, it creates a permanent bond. In fact, you try to disconnect it after it's been glued, and it doesn't pull apart so easily, does it? It tears and it rips and it does damage. And this is why sex outside of marriage creates similar psychological carnage. People get used and abused. They give their most intimate self to another person only to be rejected or laid aside. It destroys a person's self-worth. This is why God says, do it only after you say, I do. Well, next, I want you to notice the frills to sex. In chapters 2 through 5, the Shulamite, she flashes back to her courtship, Solomon's proposal, and their honeymoon. It was a spring day when he proposed. She accepted, and Solomon went to Jerusalem to prepare for the nuptials. He then returned for the wedding, and they honeymooned from Lebanon all the way back to the city of Jerusalem. And she remembers it so well. In chapter 3, verse 6, she says, who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchant's fragrant powders? Behold, it is Solomon's couch with 60 valiant men around it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night. Of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin. He made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. Now, of these frills, I want you to notice his couch and then the clothes. See, Solomon comes riding in a honeymoon limo. The palanquin was an ancient version of a mobile bedroom. Sort of an ancient version of one of those customized vans. You remember those with the stereo and the shag carpet and the opaque glass in the back? You know, the vehicle you'd never allow your single unmarried daughter to step foot in? That's what it basically was. Well, the court ladies in Jerusalem, they lined the bed with soft flower petals and scented powders. The Orientals believed that the art of lovemaking should include the stimulation of all five senses. The honeymoon environment was exciting and stimulating and soothing. Solomon's couch showed that he cared. Now, husbands, please understand this about your wife's sexual desire. Environment matters. Now, when men get aroused, all that exists in the world are two sheets and his wife. For the guy, sex is a time to block out. But for the wife, sex is a time to take in. And thus she becomes acutely aware of her surroundings. Are the clothes picked up? What do the clothes have to do with anything? We just took them off. Can the children hear us? Are the lights just right? Did we do the dishes? Do the dishes? I could care less about the dishes. I'll take care of the dishes. I'll just go downstairs and throw them all out in the backyard. I don't care about the dishes. But you see, a smart lover doesn't fight his wife on these issues. He plays by her rules, and he makes the environment they share as enticing as possible. You know, one Bible commentator, he describes the bedroom environment we would have found had we climbed into the king's palanquin. He writes, "The wall would be lined with beautiful linen and satin curtains, coated with scented powders to make the room smell erotic. The bed sheets were dusted with scented powders, as was the clothing. Furthermore, their bodies were anointed with scented lotions. To top it all off, they probably burned incense, and thus the whole room was filled with smoke. In fact, we probably would have choked." Guys, perhaps you could start with a scaled-down version. Men, draw a warm bubble bath for your wife. Just let her soak for a little while you do the dishes and do the homework and put the kids to bed. And then prep the bedroom with some soft light, some romantic music. Go buy you one of those little scented candles. Go down to the Walmart and get you one of those love songs from the 80s CDs. Give your girl a massage with that soothing lotion. Try that once a week for 3 months and tell me if you're disappointed with the results. See, Solomon shows his wisdom by sparing no expense in creating the right atmosphere for his bride. Now look, too, at the Shulamite's clothes. In chapter 4, verse 1, we're told that she's wearing a veil. In other words, sexy lingerie. An old pastor friend said to a young Charlie Shedd, "Son, you got to save money somewhere, but there are two places you should never cut back. Never try to save money on food or your wife's lingerie." We're on a spending freeze at our house. We've gotten a little bit too carried away with the old credit card. But my wife knows there is one thing that will never be questioned. When I see Victoria's Secrets, baby, that's okay. That's okay. That's okay. That one's okay. Yeah, that one's okay. No problem at all. My wife has an unlimited lingerie budget. 4, a woman will act sexy if she feels sexy, and she'll feel sexy if she looks sexy. So I'm just telling you, sell the car. You don't need but one. Refinance a house. Put new shoes for the kids on hold. They're okay. But whatever you do, don't cut back on your wife's lingerie budget. Well, 4, I want you to notice here the skill in sex. Now listen carefully as we read through chapter 4. And husbands, please take notes, because I'm afraid some of you guys are all hands. You have yet to learn that touching your wife with words does far more to arouse her sexually than you just pawing all over. And Solomon is a master at spinning a phrase. He arouses his wife by whispering compliments in her ears. Her talk, or his talk, then his tenderness, and then his touch work together to bring the Shulamite sexual satisfaction. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. He says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes." By the way, these are compliments. "Behind your veil, your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead." Now, imagine watching a flock of black goats walking down a mountainside in single file. And that gives you the idea. He's describing the locks of his wife's hair. Of course, hair like goat's hair may not mean as much to your wife as it did to Solomon's. So you might need to do a little translation work here, guys. But work at it. She'll love the effort. Verse 2, "Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from the washing. Every one of them bears twins, and none is barren among them." And apparently, she had a good orthodontist as a child. Verses 3 and 4, "Your lips are like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely." Now realize, guys, you don't come up with this kind of stuff on the spur of the moment. Solomon gave all this wording and these phrases some advanced thought, some preparation here. You got to work at this, guys. He continues, he says, "Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory. on which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Solomon loves her jewelry. He says, baby, your necklace is like an ammunition belt. He was obviously into guns. And apparently he's working his way down her body from her temples to her neck. Oh, down he goes. In verses 5 and 6, he whispers, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. And I'll just let you guess what he means by mountain of myrrh and hill of frankincense. But men, make no mistake about this. You are watching a skilled lover at work. He doesn't just jump right in and go for the big splash. He moves slowly and gently, lovingly lingering over every inch of her body. He's showing some self-restraint. He's taking some time to tell her how beautiful she is to him. This Shlomo, he knows what he's doing. Well, in verse 8, he says, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the lepers. Remember, it's only been a few days since they were in a faraway Lebanon. And he senses that her mind is now wandering. And so he addresses her concerns. Now, this may be a revolutionary concept for some of you guys, but sometimes before a wife is ready for sex, she just needs to talk. You're kidding, Pastor Sandy. No, it's true. Discuss her day. Discuss what's happening with the kids. The wise husband resists the urge to just get on with it. Instead, he remains sensitive to her needs. Now, Solomon says in verse 9, you have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Notice there, the Hebrews knew about this kind of kissing long before the French took credit for it. Verse 12 turns up the heat. He says, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. The spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Your plants are an orchid of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. Now, you need to know that gardens in biblical times were far more than just a couple of rows of tomatoes, you know. They were walled enclosures that included paths and fountains and shade and fruit trees. They had these sweet-smelling herbs and these little breezy arbors where you could sit and enjoy the refreshing effects. Well, you see, up until the honeymoon, the Shulamite's sexuality had been a garden enclosed. The wall was up. Before marriage, this garden was full of spices and sweets, but it was only for her. She owned the garden. But now she invites and entices her husband to enter that garden and to enjoy its pleasures. See, he initiates, but she doesn't just tolerate sex. She invites him in. She's concerned about his enjoyment. In verse 16, she says, awake, O north wind, come, O south, blow upon my garden that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. The Shulamite asked Solomon to arouse her passions and to enjoy its fruits. Notice here, both husband and wife are givers, not takers. There should be no selfishness in the marriage bed. The goal is to please each other, not just ourselves. I love the last half of chapter 5, verse 1. Many Bible commentators believe it's the voice of God putting his stamp of approval on their sexual expression. It says, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. You see, from the beginning, God said that it was good. Well, finally, I want you to notice the chill on sex. For in chapter 5, the Shulamite, she has a dream that warns her about some bad attitudes that are creeping into their sex life. And she says in verse 2, I sleep, but my heart is awake. In other words, this is a dream. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. Now, in her dream, Solomon is late getting home from work. Must have been the wee hours of the morning since his clothes are soaked with dew. He wants into the queen's room to initiate intimacy, but she's not willing. In verse 3, she offers a couple of really lame excuses. She says, I have taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? And I'm sure I know what Solomon's saying. Baby, don't worry about your robe. That's the last thing you're going to need. And then she says, I have washed my feet. How can I defile them? All of a sudden, she's got a clean foot fetish. What's the deal with that? What a lame excuse. See, she just doesn't want to be bothered. And she recalls in verse 4, my beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him. I rose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My heart leaped up when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. See, by the time the Shulamite rises to open the door, Solomon's gone. He has been spurned. His fragile male ego has been crushed. She realizes that he's been hurt, and she races out into the streets to find him and to apologize. Now, I'm convinced that most women don't realize how significant sex is to their husbands. Clueless might be too strong of a word, but they vastly underestimate its significance. Now, let me ask the room tonight. How many of you wives desire conversation with your husband? Raise your hand. How many of you desire conversation with your husband? Look at that. Almost everybody. Almost. How many of you would think that there's something wrong in your relationship if you lacked conversation? Raise your hand. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, wives, please recognize a simple truth. Sex is to a husband what conversation is to a wife. It is. Ladies, when the world beats your man down and his superiors mistreat him, when all his goals fall short, sex is your tool to prop up his confidence. A wife can let her husband know that at least to one person, he is still the most desirable man in the world. A sensitive woman can use her sensual charms to pump air back into his deflated sails. Through sex, she can make everything right in his world, at least for a night. She can encourage him in his manhood. Ladies, even when you do have to turn your husband down, please do it gently. Another author writes, when a wife needs to reject her husband's sexual advances, he may feel down, not just for missing out on a moment of pleasure, but his manhood may feel rejected. This is why a wise woman eases the blow by saying something like, you know, I just can't get with it tonight, baby, but I know I won't be able to stay away from a man like you for long. When I hear that, I think, oh, well, that's okay. I can look forward to tomorrow night. And ladies, make sure that those rejections are few and far between. In 1 Corinthians 7, Paul says to married couples that our bodies are not our own. Verse 4 puts it, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Therefore, he says in verse 5, do not deprive one another in the reason so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. You see, sex in marriage should consist of three F's. Make it fun, fulfilling, but perhaps most importantly, frequent. Well, the Shulamite, she makes three changes to her marriage to remove the chill that had settled over their relationship. First, she develops a new attitude toward her husband. Second, a new aggressiveness toward her husband. And third, she seeks a new atmosphere to share with her husband. And we'll close with these three changes. First, notice she adopts a new attitude toward her husband's body. Now, I want you to listen to her in chapter 5, verse 10. She says, "My beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. His head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His body is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires." Now, so far in their relationship, only Solomon has described the body of his spouse. But now the Shulamite is describing Solomon. Notice, ladies, she's training her mind to think sexually about her husband. And she, too, starts with his hair and works her way down. This ivory portion of his body is the area where the sun never shines. It stayed white. And the sapphire inlays are the blood vessels running under his skin. She says in verse 15, "His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." To some women, the word husband has become a synonym for words like provider, father, nice guy, even friend. But they have stopped associating the term with the word lover. Wives, you need to view your husband's body as God's gift to satisfy you sexually. There's nothing wrong with you thinking of your husband in an erotic and sensual and sexual way. Here, the Shulamite is daydreaming about Solomon's physical features, and it's breaking the chill. Her new attitude toward his body is arousing her sexual passion. Well, second, I want you to notice here a new sexual aggressiveness toward her husband. In chapter 7, she dances for Solomon. And understand, this is definitely not the foxtrot. This is not a square dance. Ladies, this is a very sensual, sexy, seductive dance done for the purpose of arousing her husband sexually. And it is only for the bedroom. In verse 1, Solomon talks about his wife's sandals. But that's the last stitch of clothing he mentions. Apparently, that's all she had on were her sandals. In verse 1, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman." That phrase, "the curve of your thighs," is best translated, "the vibration of your hips." The Shulamite understands that men are turned on visually, and she is providing her husband with some visual sexual stimulation. Now, when you get to your bedroom tonight, I want you to read the rest of the Song of Solomon, chapter 7. This was quite a dance. But ladies, don't miss the point here. There are times in marriage when you need to be the sexual aggressor. If your husband is the only one in the marriage initiating intimacy, he grows frustrated and he gets the impression that he's a burden to his wife. Husbands need to know that sexual desire in the marriage goes both ways. Female author Joe Berry, J-O, this is a woman talking, she writes, "One of the greatest blessings a husband receives is when his wife takes the initiative. Those are the times he cherishes in his heart. Just as a woman cherishes an unexpected gift or a bouquet of flowers, a couple's sex life will be very one-sided and vital lines of communication blocked if the husband always has to be the one to institute sex." The Shulamite understood this, and she worked through whatever reservation she had to bless her husband. Many wives are afraid that if they show too much sexual interest toward their husband, he'll become more obsessed with sex than he already is. But that is seldom true. Ladies, I have a question for you. When are you most obsessed with food? Answer, when you're on a diet. You're trying to diet. That's all you can think about. Your obsession with food dissipates when you know you can eat all that you want. And wife, you will find the same is true with your husband's sexual appetites. Take your old boy off the diet, and he might just settle into a frequency that's comfortable for you both. Well, finally, I want you to notice a new atmosphere. Look at chapter 7, verse 11. Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The Shulamite knows that a change of scenery often helps to renew sexual intimacy. So she suggests a trip to the countryside. Perhaps your marriage could benefit from the same. A cruise, maybe, or maybe a trip to the mountains. Well, in conclusion, let me summarize what we've learned. The bill for a vibrant sex life is, men, a sensitivity to your wife's insecurities. The thrill is accentuated by wooing and wording. Work at that wording now. And there's a warning. Don't forget the frills, the couch, and the clothes. The skill involves talk, tenderness, then touch. And the chill is broken by a change of attitude and aggressiveness and atmosphere. And as with all of life, sex included, things go better with God. If you want the best sex life possible, do it God's way. Hey, follow the Bible, the owner's manual, and before long, your spouse will be in that pickup honking the horn.